Good morning. Well, when you hear that theme song, you know it's Monday morning and time for Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren. Doug Wells taking the day off on a little bit of a vacation, and Bob Hendricks is sitting in. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Nice to be here today.
And it's nice to have you. And boy, we've got a goofy weather forecast for the week. It's going to be wet all week. We're expecting perhaps snow showers by tonight. And snow is in the forecast almost every night as a possibility. And when it isn't snowing, it could be raining. So, interesting week coming up. Weather-wise, the seasons, they are a-changing. Well, we've got a fun show today. Mixing two of my favorite subjects, business and history. So we have Ben Waterhouse standing by on the line. He is the author of The Land of Enterprise, a business history of the United States, all about from colonial times on. How has business evolved?
Then at 9:30, we welcome Jaron Hall. He's the student chairman of LaSalle at the U of U. He has results of an award ceremony held there recently. Also in studio later on, HOA attorney Robert Rossing will talk about significant changes to condominium and community association laws that were enacted this year. Those guests and more coming up this morning here on KPCW Mountain Money.
Morning Edition and Morning News with Leslie Thatcher is brought to you in part by Park City Hospital, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, the Promontory Foundation, and All Seasons Resort Lodging.
This is Suzanne Harris Cooper with Chin McCoy Fleming Harris and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. I love supporting and listening to KPCW, especially every Thursday morning from 10 to noon when my husband Craig Cooper is the volunteer DJ. Thanks for keeping us updated about all things Park City, KPCW.
Welcome back to Mountain Money on KPCW. We have on the line with us Ben Waterhouse. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He's a graduate of Princeton, received a PhD in history from Harvard, and is the associate professor and scholar at the University of North Carolina. Written a previous book, probably several, but one of the latest was Lobbying America, The Politics of Business from Nixon to NAFTA. Welcome to Mountain Money, Ben.
Well, thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, and clearly you have an interest in the history of business, so let's dive into that topic. And I thought America was founded for religious freedom purposes. You would say, well, yeah, sorta, but it was also a land of new opportunity.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, what I try to do with this book, The Land of Enterprise, is weave the story of business into the story of American history that maybe folks are a little bit more familiar with. And part of that does involve both the founding of the country with the Constitution in the late 1700s, but even going all the way back to the European conquest of the American continents as early as 1500. So, yes, there's an economic imperative behind that entire experience. Certainly, we talk about the Spanish and the Portuguese settlers and explorers and conquerors in South America searching for gold and silver. A lot of times we don't realize that the first English colonists in places like Virginia were also searching for gold and silver. They just didn't quite have as much luck as the folks in the southern hemisphere.
Yeah, I would imagine it was, I mean, as daunting a challenge as going to the moon for the current or previous generation in America, to mount an expedition to pretty much the unknown, chartering a ship to get you there and the sailors to get you there. So who financed the early trips to the New World?
Well, most of these early expeditions were financed by corporations, by what were called joint stock companies, and these were legal entities. They were chartered by the crown in Britain, and they were given a specific sort of legally sanctioned right and even a monopoly right to explore and set up settlements in certain areas. The Virginia Company was the first one that had this sort of purview in what would become the United States, and the Massachusetts Bay Company, now only about 13 years later, followed in the same footsteps. So these were designed to be money-making ventures. They attracted employees, people who would actually do the take the transatlantic journey and do the work of trying to set up settlements, homes, farms, and so forth, also dealing with the fact that they weren't by any stretch alone. There were a lot of indigenous people that they ultimately fought with and went to war with. But they were there, those employees, as you said, for a variety of reasons. Many of them were fleeing religious persecution. Many others were simply pursuing an economic better life, or at least the idea that they might have the chance of one. I think, when we look at how many people ended up starving and dying of disease, it didn't prove to be a much better life for the vast majority of those early people.
Yeah, I was going to ask you later on the whole notion of publicly owned companies and when that started. So there were publicly owned companies back in colonial times and before,
yes,
I suppose.
There were, right. They go back. There weren't very many of them, but the concept of a corporation really does have its origins. Some historians will put it as far back as the Middle Ages, and certainly in the early modern period, you had European monarchs granting these charters of incorporation to basically specific wealthy individuals. And what was key about this corporate charter was that it provided a certain degree of protection to the investors in sort of limiting their liability. And this is the origin of what we have now as limited liability companies.
Ben, jumping ahead just a little bit, you write in your book, the U.S. Constitution created both a unified national government and a unified national market. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a point that I try to make early in this story. The section of the Constitution that really had the most economic effects on the country was Article 1, Section 8. And it's actually the longest part of the Constitution. It's a long list of things that Congress has the right to do. And when you look at that from the perspective of business interests, you'll see that it makes a lot of things easier to do, a business easier to conduct, things that we often think about when I teach college students about the founding of the country. We say, "Oh, yes, the Articles of Confederation were weak, and they didn't have a central taxing authority, and everybody had their own money." But it goes beyond that. The Interstate Commerce Clause is part of that section of the Constitution, and that allows the federal government to oversee trade between states, and it makes it basically a free, competitive area, so that the state of North Carolina, for example, where I live, couldn't put, import tariffs on tobacco coming in from Virginia.
Yeah. So the today, companies, corporations talk about their corporate responsibility, and they publicize and they're giving back to the community, and that sort of thing. Some are sincere, some maybe less sincere, but they know they have to do it. Was there any requirement or compulsion on the part of early corporate leaders back to colonial times and through the Industrial Revolution even for companies to give back and show demonstrate social responsibility?
In a manner of speaking, there was. In the earliest types of corporations that I was describing in the colonial period, the monopoly power came from the monarch, and then once this sort of became after the American Revolution, that became more centralized in state legislatures. If the crown or if the government is going to grant a company a right to be a corporation and sort of back up their debts and provide that sort of limited liability, there was always an implicit idea that the company was serving the public good. Now, that would be for corporations. There was less, or in fact, no particular requirement on the vast majority of businesses throughout the colonial period and really into the early part of the 19th century, because most businesses were not organized as corporations. They were farms or mills or manufacturers of some sort, and they didn't have that sort of government. They didn't have the official stamp of the government as a corporation. By the time you get to the late 19th century, the Industrial Revolution, as you were talking about, incorporation became much, much more common, and states in particular found ways to make this go a lot faster and smoother by creating something called general incorporation laws, which basically meant that in order to become a corporation, you simply had to fill out paperwork rather than get the state legislature to vote on your specific case. This creates a lot of sort of public tension and public debate because, for exactly the reasons that you suggest, the implication had always been that a corporation was sort of part of the fabric of society, and that was true, or maybe when they were very, very few. When corporations started to become much more numerous and much larger, there's a lot of public pushback to it. Sometimes this results in new laws and restrictions on corporate activity, and in many cases it did, in fact, push early large corporations by this sort of late 19th century to explicitly engage in philanthropy and other types of sort of social activism in the hope of sort of forestalling public scrutiny and any other type of government regulation. Andrew Carnegie is probably the most famous of those kind of major industrialists who committed tremendous amounts of money to philanthropies, libraries, and so forth.
You're talking about Andrew Carnegie. There have been many that have helped shape our nation, many people. The relationship between our economic, social, and political landscape. Name some other names we might be familiar with or may not be familiar that were important.
What I try to do in The Land of Enterprise, as I said, is take the broader story of American history and point out where it intersects with the story of business. And so I certainly write about people like Henry Ford or John Rockefeller, but I also try to focus on people in other sort of aspects of the social world who responded to the growth of corporations and the rise of big business in particular by sort of trying to oppose it or trying to put some roadblocks in the way. For example, I talk a bit about William Jennings Bryan running for president in 1896 and several other times, but most famously when he took aim at big bankers and the gold standard and large industrialists. But that story carries all the way through to people like Ralph Nader in the 1960s, organizing consumers and pushing for greater regulations on types of products that businesses were creating or environmental consequences.
Yeah, you know, today there's a lot of resentment about the wealth gap between the workers and the CEOs and the disparity in pay where workers are still struggle to create and maintain a middle class living standard while people just become obscenely rich. But that's not a new phenomenon, is it? I mean, yeah, you go to Carnegie and any of those early industrialists must have made outrageously more than their employees.
Well, they certainly did. You know, the story of industrial capitalism is the story of wealth and capital accruing to the top. Now, as that system became more larger and more complex, the rewards to the top grew, and so the disparities that you're describing would have really reached a high point in the early part of the 20th century as these industrial corporations got so large. However, there are ways to check and sort of mitigate those effects, and so what we see historically throughout the middle part of the 20th century is in fact a contraction, and through a variety of means, through tax codes and minimum wages and unions, we actually did see somewhat of a compression between sort of the wealth at the top and the wealth of or the income of workers. On the flip side, what we've seen since the 1960s is or 1970s is the weakening of those provisions, minimum wage laws, tax policies, and so forth. And so we're sort of back to a point now that resembles a lot more what the late 19th century looked like, the days of Rockefeller.
You know, it seems like today the instant billionaires and millionaires we hear about coming out of the tech world become rich not so much for creating products as creating ideas that may or may not go anywhere, and they become instantly rich the day their company goes public. Is that a fairly new phenomenon, this taking a private company public and selling your interests at the front end of the life of the company rather than sticking with it and owning it all like a Carnegie in the past?
Yeah, I think it is pretty new. And one of the stories that runs through the book I wrote, The Land of Enterprise, is that there's a sort of history to the role of finance in general and financial capital that takes on a much larger role in the second half of the 20th century. And it's because of this new attention to finance and the number of people who are making investments, the amount of money that's there to be invested, that this sort of IPO raise that you're describing can even happen in the first place. It's because there are venture capitalists who are looking for the most fruitful ways to take the money they have and turn it into more money, which is effectively what capitalists do, that any of this can happen in the first place. So the degree of capitalization, the ability to cash out, like you described, is, I think, historically distinct to the last 25 years or so. We certainly saw it a lot in the 1990s at the beginning of the internet boom, and we still see it today.
We talk about internet, our consumer-oriented world, corporate brands. We could jump now to the president and his children and their brands and all that they are doing. How is this affect? Are we becoming very suspicious of this, or is this just normal evolution?
Well, I think there's a fascinating history to the role of brands in people's lives and their the ability of these products to really shape the way people think about themselves. And to a degree, we may be, you know, and again, I'm a historian who's more accustomed to looking backwards than forward, so it's hard for me to say whether we've become completely numb to it all. But I would say that, you know, this is a function of modern capitalism, and it's a story that has taken place really over most of the last 100 years. It was about 100 years ago in the early part of the 20th century that corporations, especially those who were making products for consumers for daily use, became large enough and national enough to really start to pour lots of money into advertising. And as they did, as the advertising business emerged and then matured, they noticed that this branding would really have a profound effect on how people thought about themselves, how people behaved. And there were corporations coming out of Madison Avenue or working with Madison Avenue as early as the 1920s, deliberately trying to shape people's lives. I tell the story in this book about Listerine, for example, which is a perfectly normal product that we think about today. But when it first kind of came into the consumer world, it had previously just been an antiseptic used for surgery. What happens in the 1920s is that the company that made it teamed up with some advertisers and created a concept called halitosis, which, you know, is as old as people, but they gave it a new medical-sounding name, and suddenly it became a condition that you had to treat by gargling with Listerine.
They created a demand where no demand previously existed. You know, we had a marketing expert on this show a few months ago, and he said, you know, do you know the most famous, most effective line ever in advertising? And we said no, and he said it was the shampoo marketer who came up with lather, rinse, repeat.
And
he said in a day he doubled the demand for shampoo by telling everybody they needed to do it twice. So
yeah, yeah. That's right. Well, and this, as I said, this process of kind of creating demand of ultimately shapes the way we think about ourselves, and advertisers play a tremendous role in that. I think there are debates today about whether new types of advertisements and especially in the social media landscape, continue to do this. But I mean, I think this is something that we've been seeing for 100 years.
Yeah, you know, your book is Land of Enterprise, A Business History of the U.S., but let's spread it worldwide. The world's gotten flat, and has capitalism has become obviously the winning strategy worldwide. But that's happened rather recently with the collapse of communism. I mean, I think of non-capitalist societies. We're down to about North Korea, aren't we?
I think, in a way, yes, but in another sense, this gets this conversation gets a little bit more confusing when we try to think of capitalism as a historical phenomenon rather than simply a set of policies that an individual country puts into place. Because even during the 20th century, when you had the Soviet Union and many other state socialist systems, all of those countries operated within a broader global context that was fundamentally shaped by this longer process called capitalism. And the capitalism that we have today is historically different. Capitalism changes over time. It's not a sort of fixed natural state. But I think, you know, it is fair to say that the world is more globalized and globally connected now than ever before. The questions that we have, and what I hope the lessons of history can help shed light on, is what kind of capitalism we want, and how can we structure it, how can we manage it?
Yeah, you know, another issue that I wanted to discuss is, and now I just lost what it was, but entrepreneurship. Our next segment is going to dwell on entrepreneurship. Most of these, did it come down in most of these giant corporations that formed in the industrial age? Did it come down to one person, or a collective, or like a Henry Ford or an Andrew Carnegie? Or was it public companies and hired guns who made the big corporations of America today?
Well, what really made the big corporations is a story that goes back to the rise of the railroads in the years after the Civil War. What really made these corporations distinctive and really new in the face of the whole of business history all the way back is the prominence of managers and people that you don't necessarily think of as the kind of driving forces of the business world. In the 1870s, railroad companies in particular started streamlining their structures in much more almost military ways. They were much, much more hierarchical, and this allowed them to have greater divisions and to really put a premium on management. And the rise of management from the late 19th century really well into the 20th century was the key thing that allowed corporations to get very, very large. Because no matter how smart your founder is, or no matter how innovative or entrepreneurial, there's a limit to how big you can get if everything's being managed from one person. So it's the sort of rise of this multi-divisional firm that allows corporations to get large, then to get even larger by merging with others, and so forth. And so I think, you know, that's really it's an unsung story, I think, of American business, the rise of managerial capitalism.
You know, another rise, the rise of finance, of merchant banking, investment banking, has that always been a key part of the business history of the United States? What I'm getting at is today you see financiers creating financial products and selling them to investors, and a lot of people getting rich, and I don't see what the product is at the end of the day. They're just churning money in different ways to get an extra slice of a percentage of return. And of course, the infamous example are the credit default swaps and the mortgage-backed securities that brought us almost down within the last decade.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think the scope of what you're describing today is historically distinct. There's a term that some sociologists and historians sometimes use called financialization, which refers to the sort of complete focus of the economy, of the business sector, on generating returns to capital and borrowing money in particular in order to maximize a return. And this is a phenomenon of the last 30 to 40 years. All that being said, finance, as we know it today, was really instrumental to the rise of big businesses in the late 19th century. People like J.P. Morgan were foundational to the spread of these large integrated corporations like the big railroads and steel companies and things like that. So the idea of having bankers kind of at the center underwriting these mergers was a critical part of capitalism as it came to exist by the late 19th century. What's different, I think, today is the sheer quantity of capital and the decline in regulations and the decline in restrictions on banking activities and so forth since the late 1970s has created a world where, as you described, people can get very, very wealthy by being in just the right place at the right time, leveraging what they have, and really making a killing off of a tiny little percentage move in the value of something.
You have a statement in your book that says, business doesn't always get its way in Washington, but it tries. This has to be something from the very beginning.
It's certainly true. Back to the very beginning, there were profound arguments about what kinds of policies the government should put in place and not necessarily whether they should benefit business, but which businesses they should benefit. And one of the stories that I tell in The Land of Enterprise is the dispute or the debate between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton from the very beginning, from the Washington administration in the 1790s. Jefferson favored farmers, and he favored trade policies that allowed farmers to sell their goods more competitively abroad through fair trade. Hamilton was largely a partisan of small manufacturers, and all manufacturers at the time were small, but they were being outcompeted by basically better builders in Britain. Hamilton proposed tariffs, and he proposed other restrictions that would allow that would protect those kind of budding industrialists. And Jefferson pushed right back, and so there was a protracted debate throughout the 19th century on trade, on tariffs, on whether to give subsidies to industrialists. Eventually, we end up giving subsidies to farmers.
Very fine. Well, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Benjamin Waterhouse, a professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill and author of The Land of Enterprise, A Business History of the United States, just out about 2 weeks now from Simon & Schuster. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Been a pleasure. Now let's turn to the weather. We're not even going to hit 50 today. High of 48 and scattered showers likely, turning very likely, 90% chance by this evening. And then starting tomorrow, it gets even colder and at night, and snow flurries are in the forecast. Depending on the temperature, either snow flurries or showers all the way through Friday. So, well, when we come back, we're going to talk about the Lassonde Institute at the University of Utah and an interesting contest they ran for high school entrepreneurs. We'll be talking with them after this.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, presenting Viridian, 21 new residences along the 11th fairway of the Canyons Golf Course with year-round amenities and gondola access. Summer's on the fairway, winter's on the slopes. More information at ViridianParkCity.com.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays.
Good morning. It's 9:36. On to guest number two, Jaron Hall, who's student chairman of the Lassonde Institute, Entrepreneur Institute at the University of Utah. Jaron, I've had to spell that 3 or 4 times now, writing an intro, and I spell it a different way every time. Entrepreneur, it's a tough word, but it's a great subject. Jaron, welcome, and it's nice to have you with us today.
Oh, yeah, you bet. I'm honored.
Now, as I mentioned, you're the student chairman. Tell me a little bit about what your role is at the Lausanne Institute.
Yeah, you bet. So at the Lausanne Institute, there are a bunch of programs that they offer, and they're all ran by students. So there's some that are like workshops and meetups, and then there's some like mine, which is the competition series. So I'm the chair of what's called the Utah Entrepreneur Series, which is a series of competitions that that we run. So one of them is the Opportunity Quest competition, which is just the competition for the University of Utah, and then I just the Utah Entrepreneur Challenge, which is the big one that was just, you know, a couple Saturdays ago, and that's the one that I run among with another few student partners that help me out with it.
Yeah, and let's talk about that competition. Well, first of all, let's go back a step. We had the director of the Lausanne Entrepreneur Institute on our show several months ago when the Lausanne Institute opened. Just talk a little bit about the institute itself. What sets it apart? It's like you live where you go to school, right? And you just steep yourself in ideas all day and all night.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So the Lausanne Entrepreneur Institute has been around for a while. It's been around for years. But it wasn't until the brand new building that you're talking about, the Lausanne Studios, when that opened up, that it really kind of brought a lot of attention. So, yeah, that's absolutely right. So the first floor is kind of a floor that's open to anybody, and it has a make space with tools and everything, and it has a co-work space and like a company launch space, which I'm actually a part of, where I have office space that I'm available to use for free. And then the upper floors, there's like 4 or 5 floors that all have students living in them, and they call them the Lausanne 400. So there's 400 students there from all different backgrounds, all different majors, and all different ages that are living there together in these dorm rooms. And they, you know, have to go through a process to kind of get approved to live there. And then they live there, and they're kind of themed for entrepreneurship topics. And then they're available to like exclusive events as well if they live in the building. And then all the tools and everything in the first floor that they're available to use, too.
Yeah, and so the idea is get collaborations going. You might have somebody who's a biology student, not majoring in business at all, but has some idea about a process that could become a product, and then they team up with someone they meet at the institute and carry through with their idea. So this high school entrepreneur challenge was funded by Zions Bank. You had money available in cash and prizes to high school kids who could come up with the kinds of things that you're trying to come up with at the college level. So talk a little bit about this competition, and then we'll get into who some of the winners were.
Yeah, you bet. So we've had the Utah Entrepreneur Challenge, like the collegiate version, for I think about 10 years now. And it wasn't until recently, I think maybe 2 years ago, that they started the high school version of that. And the high school version is pretty much identical to the college version in that it's a statewide competition. They invite high schools from all over the state to compete. And these high school kids get to come and pitch their ideas, you know, submit a business plan, and it goes through some voting. And then if they make it into kind of the top round for the high school version, it's the top 24. So the top 24 high school teams get to come up on campus. And they got to pitch to judges on the same day as our competition, and kind of combine it into one big event. And so these high school kids, they have some really impressive things, definitely more impressive than what I was doing when I was in high school. So it was really great to have them there. And then, of course, yeah, like you mentioned, Zions Bank, they sponsor both the high school Utah Entrepreneur Challenge and the collegiate Utah Entrepreneur Challenge for all the prize money and the resources to host this big statewide event.
That's what I was going to ask you. You don't have the a benefit of age to look back and see if high school kids are coming up with more sophisticated ideas when you were in high school, because that was only a few years ago for you. But but you still sense a bit of a difference that they're becoming more sophisticated about business and creation of products that can become companies.
Yeah, absolutely right. High schools are coming up with more and more programs to help them. So I even have little brothers who are approaching high school, and they're already able to take like technology and entrepreneurship type classes, which I think is great.
To move from high school into the collegiate level, is it a GPA? Is it how do you make that move if you're a high school student?
To make it into the competition?
Well, to actually become part of the Lausanne Institute.
Oh, sure. So the Lausanne Institute is actually just open to anybody. It's not the only part that people have to apply for is to live in that building. But really, the resources and everything are available to all campus. So, and even other schools too. So, like the resources, like I talked about, like the workshops and the meetups, they have like hours with experts and they host events to help tutor people really. To help them get the help that they need. Those are open to anybody. So it doesn't matter what GPA you have. Really just if you have the idea and you need the help and you come to them, then they'll help you out.
Okay, so let's talk about the grand prize winners of the high school ideas. And one comes out of Park City in partnership with Roland Hall, the Colo Clean. This seems like an awfully sophisticated thing for high school kids to think up. Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, so like I said, we have the High School Entrepreneur Challenge and then the Collegiate Entrepreneur Challenge. And I ran the collegiate version, and then Stephanie, she was running the high school version. So I wasn't as familiar with all of the high school teams as much as I was with the college teams. But yeah, I did have a chance to walk around and see them. And the Colo Clean, they also competed in another competition that the University of Utah hosts called Bench to Bedside, and they won a prize for that as well. So it really just was fascinating that these high school kids were able to go to both these competitions and win some prize money for both.
Yeah, well, let me read the synopsis of Colo Clean, which came from Park City and Roland Hall students, an alternative colonoscopy preparation kit. Their mission is to provide an effective, humane, personalized colonoscopy prep kit that keeps prep less burdensome for the patient. That just doesn't seem like something high school kids would even be thinking about. Let's go on to another one. Straight Shot. What was that about?
Straight Shot, was that another high school team?
Yeah, that's it's along the same lines. It's adaptive apparel and clothing company that will provide ease in accessing areas to administer medications by injection, port, feeding tubes, or other ways. So I suppose it's like clothing with Velcro openings or something where you need to inject medicine into a port.
And yeah, these high school kids are just so sophisticated.
Yeah, it's incredible. I'm just amazed. And then the third winner was the puzzle panel from the Academy for Math, Engineering, and Science, which is a high school charter school probably in Salt Lake. And that is portable solar panels that would eventually be able to be deployed at emergency sites and set up quickly to generate power. And obviously, there would be lots of emergency applications for that one as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, amazing ideas. And so, where do you see your career going? Do you have a hot idea like that that you think you can work on right out of college and in college?
Yeah, well, that's the plan. So I'm graduating in just a couple weeks. So it was really an honor to be able to run this competition and then graduate. But once I graduate, I have a house cleaning business that I currently run right now called Utah Maids. Mm-hmm. And that's a house cleaning business that I started about a year ago where people can book their home cleanings online and they don't have to call. And so it feels kind of like the simplicity of, you know, ordering an Uber but for a house cleaning job. So I'll just plan on doing that as soon as I graduate, and hopefully I won't need to get another job. I can just keep doing what I'm doing.
And I presume you're not one of the maids who has to run out and...
Nope, not anymore. When I started it, I had to fill in, but now I have homes being cleaned right now as we speak.
Okay, so you're on the software side of it, making it easy to schedule it. Well, thanks very much. Appreciate your being with us. Jaron Hall, a student chairman of Lausanne at the University of Utah. Thanks for being with us.
You bet. Thank you very much.
And we're headed to a high of just 48 today, a little bit higher over in the Heber Valley. And we will be back to talk about changes in HOA laws that have just taken effect and what you need to know if you live in one or manage one. We'll be back after this.
Hi, this is Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's annual summer concerts return to Canyons Village on June 24th and continues throughout the summer on select Saturdays. Live music begins at 6 o'clock and is open to all ages. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
This is Matt Mitten, attorney with Jones Waldo, a Park City law firm. Longtime supporters of KPCW, our firm provides estate planning and other personal legal services to residents of Summit County and beyond. We are online at joneswaldo.com and 435-200-0085.
947, 33 degrees here in Old Town. Our final guest today is HOA attorney Robert Rosing, talking about significant changes to condominium and community association laws that were enacted this year. Welcome. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Yeah, so just about everybody in Park City, it seems, lives in an HOA. Are there significant changes this year? The legislature meets every year, and do they always tweak the HOA law? Is there always something new?
Lately, they seem to be kind of on the warpath. HOAs and condominiums laws, we have sort of the pro-HOA group that tries to pass legislation. And then there are a variety of other groups that are out there, whether they're the builders or the bankers or this year the solar industry, pushing legislation through the legislature. And sometimes we come out ahead, and sometimes some of the legislation, as an HOA attorney, I'm not as excited about. So this year was a pretty active session for HOA and condominiums. We had a solar panel statute that got pushed through, which I think it does not affect condominiums. It only affects homeowners associations, single-family homes.
Okay.
But
what makes it easier, makes it harder?
Well, what it does is it basically says to associations, you can ban solar panels altogether by amending your governing documents, the 67% vote, or you have very little control over solar panels. It's a bill designed to make it easier for the solar people who want solar to put solar up, regardless of what it looks like or whether the association might have some issue with where it's going or, you know, the color of it or something.
Yeah, the battles, and I've been in several HOAs, and I've also done news stories about others battling their HOAs. I remember one a place in Sandy where a veteran wanted to put up a flag. He put up the American flag. What's more patriotic than that? And yet the HOA said, take that down. It's not allowed. And there was a big brouhaha over that. So it's always a matter of I suppose, personal freedom and how much of it you give up when you enter into an association.
Many people have no idea just how powerful an association can be, and just how much control they do give up when they move into an association.
And then you butt up against it's my private property.
Exactly. And that's the fight that we see play out, everywhere. On the one hand, if you want a neighborhood that looks consistently nice, that doesn't have giant pink houses, I was talking to Randy Barton last year about HOAs, and we had a whole discussion about his desire to be able to build a giant pink house in his neighborhood.
And That would be Randy.
And, you know, if you're okay with that, then you can have all the personal freedom you want. Don't live in an HOA. If you want a more consistent neighborhood, and the builders have figured out that generally, my understanding is homes will sell for about 10% more in an HOA. And then the cities like them because they can, some municipal responsibilities can typically be given to the HOA, like responsibility for the roads. And then the city thinks, hey, this is great. We don't have to maintain those roads. And so they'll give the developer more density, which is why most new construction, especially up here, but most new construction nationwide is in an HOA or some other community association. And they do have, in some sense, enormous control over what happens in the neighborhood.
Okay, so one change this year was by a two-thirds vote, an association can ban solar panels. But I would think in this green county we're in that you're not going to get a two-thirds vote against solar panels. So maybe that's a little easier now. What else came through in the legislature?
Another bill this year that was pretty big, it's called HB 157, had sort of a generic name, common area ownership changes or something like that. I call it the adding insult to injury bill. It has to do with the ability of associations to sue the developer, the builder, the declarant for construction defects. In Utah, it's already very difficult to sue a builder, just generally speaking, relative to other states.
That wouldn't have anything to do with the number of builders in the Utah legislature, would it?
Nothing at all, I'm sure. Nothing at all. So it's already very difficult, and that's sort of a whole – that's a two-hour discussion by itself as to why it's so difficult. But this bill made it so that if an HOA wants to – say a condominium association, this applies to all HOAs, you know, has there's systemic defects in the flashing. So every building has water intrusion. And so it doesn't make sense for individual owners to sue. You have the association sue on behalf of all the owners. Now, before you do that, there's a sequence of steps that the association has to jump through, hoops they have to jump through before they can even file the lawsuit. And then once they file the lawsuit, they run into all the other problems that make it difficult to sue to sue builders here in Utah. They have to have special meetings and special notice and get opinion letters from attorneys, so that's more work for us. They have to raise money in advance and put it in a trust fund, and so it just makes it a little bit harder. Another bill that passed.
Okay. What's another?
Another one that passed was – this is something that attorneys love, but it's HB 201 – the governing document hierarchy for associations. So most people probably, this won't impact most people, I would say, in their everyday life, you know, if they live in an association, but attorneys like it. It has to do with the priority of all the different things that rule over you in an association. So there's the statutes, the recorded CC&Rs, articles of incorporation, the bylaws, the plats, and this statute made clear how those documents fit together. So again, it's kind of – I think that's more of a big deal for attorneys than for anybody else. Another one that passed was the HB 75 called the Common Ownership Amendments, another sort of very generic name. This one made a small change to the nightly rental regime, the short-term rental rule. The change itself wasn't that big. The reason that I've been talking to a lot of people about this statute is just that it's the culmination of many years, let's say the last 3 to 5 years, of significant legislation on how associations can regulate and not regulate short-term rentals and nightly rentals.
So that's a big deal up here, certainly. So does it make nightly rental easier or more difficult?
This one... I suppose it asks from whose perspective are we speaking? This was probably more of a cleanup, but previous statutes made, and this, so it's the culmination of several statutes, previous statutes made nightly rentals easier, I would say, made it harder for the association to restrict them. There was this belief for many years that, you know, associations, long-term owners just hated short-term renters. And so this... there's been just a lot of legislation, and it's fairly complicated, frankly, as to how associations can and cannot restrict those rentals.
So consult your HOA.
I hate to say it,
one.
But yes.
Or your HOA attorney.
I don't think people realize the restrictions. When I first moved into an HOA, that there are painting the front door, the proper screen door, the proper landscaping, the care of the private road in front of the residence, the gated community. There's so much that is controlled by the HOA. It was just incredible to me.
A lot of people have no idea. And the other thing is that it's hard to tell just by looking at, say, when you go to buy a house and your real estate agent hands you a stack of papers and says these are the governing documents. Is this an active association? Does this association even meet? Do they have meetings? Or maybe they're very active. And it can be very difficult to tell because all of them have that thick stack of paper that allegedly governs the association.
And then, I've been an officer of a couple of different HOAs. Is anyone who's in leadership of an HOA exposing themselves to legal liability if other homeowners don't like what you're doing?
The lawyer's favorite answer, maybe. generally speaking, we and the legislature and the statutes and these governing documents go out of their way to try to protect people who step into those leadership roles, because otherwise no one would ever volunteer, right? I mean, if you could get sued, unfortunately, it's possible to sue the board members. And you can imagine every time an owner comes in to the attorney's office and says, this HOA is out to get me, they're terrible people, they're horrible, the first thing they want to do is sue the board members directly.
Yeah,
it's very difficult to do. It's usually not a good idea, but it can be done.
Anybody with a filing fee can file a lawsuit.
Yes.
Okay, well, thanks so much for joining us, Robert Rosing of Rona Dubois Law Firm in town. And if you're in an HOA, there are some changes afoot, as there are every year. And we'll be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. I want to thank our guest this morning, Ben Waterhouse, who wrote the book Land of Enterprise, A Business History of the United States. Interesting stuff. Jaron Hall, the student chair of the LaSonde Entrepreneurial Institute at the U, and the HOA attorney, Robert Rosing.
Thanks to our great sponsors for Mountain Money, Mountain West Bank, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, All Resort Express, Park City Mountain, and Apex Residences, and Viridian Park City, Columbus Pacific Properties.
Yes, and also want to remind you of the weather, showers and snow showers, depending on the temperatures, all week long, heading to a high of about 48 today. And just a quick note while we have a minute. You know, I used to live for a year long ago in Alexandria, Virginia, and downtown there was a little cafe in an old stone and brick building, and it was George Washington's cotton warehouse.
Uh-oh.
And I just thought that was just an amazing, you know, there was a guy who was in business a couple hundred years ago, but was more well known for being father of the whole country. And the last time I went back was about 2 years ago, went back to there, and it was a Starbucks. if that doesn't say something about
wonder how
American,
George would feel about that, yeah.
Yeah, about American business from George Washington's warehouse to a Starbucks.